crisp and beautiful this morning. And actually, it's a different kind of crisp and clear. You can feel the difference. It's kind of funny. It feels like the region is on the approach for opening day. Well less now than 2 weeks away. In fact, today's the 14th, right? So opening day draw a week from today. And in fact, we'll talk a little bit about the meet. Nate Newby is going to stop by at some point. Nate's got, you know, the typical racetrack general manager kind of activities to look forward to. But I suppose, you know, being here 6 to 9 makes it a little bit easier before the day starts to really engage. But you can see that around the plant, things are getting ready. Lots of activity, and whether it's the landscape side of things, or you know, the more heavy lifting type. And of course, you know, it's not like Saratoga, where you know the facility sits from Labor Day until July. It's a little different, but there's always lots to do when you get ready for a new meet. And there is really no venue quite like this. Our biggest racetracks are all pretty spectacular, and small ones too. But I've always said that coming here, for those that have ever been on a cruise ship, and a real cruise ship, not these cockamamie 17-story monstrosities. That looked like no, that's not a cruise ship. I'm sorry. as the son of a travel agent, my mother, that got us on a few cruises. I'm talking old school cruising. That's what this. I've always said that when I first came here in the '90s. The first thing I thought of was this is literally, you know, like a post-war era cruise liner. We sailed when I was a kid. We sailed on the Raffaello, the Italian line, and later the Veendam, the Holland America line, and that was actually a slightly newer ship. Raffaello wasn't that old. It was a '60s era and a design marvel, but I've been on others. I was on the SS France. I was on the Maxim Gorky, actually. We were on a cruise. I think it might have been when we were, I think it was on, when we were on, it might have been 70, 71, 72, and the Maxim Gorky was anchored somewhere, and the tenders could take you. They were letting people from both cruises go visit the other ships. But that's what this is like. There's an elegance here, and you know, just a grandiosity that it really isn't like anywhere else. It's hard to, you know, the timing of the building, and you want, you know, it's funny because one of its qualities and charms is that as big as it is, it doesn't suffer from the challenge that Belmont, for instance, is dealing with. And of course, Belmont, there's going to be a new Belmont, and so that'll be a get up here. I think we've got our first live fish, and in John Sheriff's, and I owed you a visit anyway. God bless the horsemen that are up and out early. because you won't be able to beat this, and he'll appreciate it because nobody's got a better appreciation for history of the game than John Sheriff's. And I, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
It's so good to see you. There we go. I've been here for the slow progression toward comfort. This has been an experience this week, starting Monday with the high 30s and freezing rain.
Yeah, it's been a little chilly, but it's beautiful when the sun comes up.
Exactly, and the snow capping the other day was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really nice.
I got to put that picture up. I was kind of waxing poetic about the facility and preparations for the 26th. And I was explaining when I first came here in 93, was my first trip here. The first thing I thought of, it reminded me of a cruise ship, of an old-fashioned cruise ship.
Yeah, it's really beautiful, and the paddock is just spectacular. I mean, it's just fun to walk around the paddock, and where Lucky Baldwin has some of the American Derby horses buried. You know, it's just that everywhere you go in the paddock, there's a little bit of history.
Well, and that's true. I mean, everywhere you go here, and of course the grading up, the grading on the front side, those grills, including the George Wolfe, the apocryphal, fallen jock in the grate. There's so many things, and in fact, I had lunch yesterday with John Parada and Jay Hubdy, and we were talking a lot of that kind of history. And Jay actually was, and maybe you have this answer, he's been trying to track down the sham, statue from Hollywood.
Native Diver?
Well, the whole...
Yeah, right.
That monolith.
Right, yeah.
And then the... the stat, no one seems to know where it is.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think possibly Tom Shapiro would know.
All right.
Yeah, Tom Shapiro's grandfather was the owner of a Native Diver.
Well, you hope it's not somewhere under SoFi Stadium is the concern.
Oh no, I'm sure because at the end of Hollywood Park, a lot of the stuff they put up for auction, I think Lee Bow offered some things to owners that would be significant, too.
Well, I guess Jay reached out to Jack Lee Bow, and Jack didn't know where... it's a little disconcerting. Well, for you, talk a little bit about... I'm heading to Oklahoma this afternoon, so it's the last day here, and I'll be back in probably February, but look ahead to the meet.
Yeah, well, it's always exciting. Starts off on December 26th, and they have a great day of racing. It's a long meet, so there's plenty of opportunities.
Swaps, by the way. I don't know why I was drawing the blank on swaps.
Idea.
Thank you. Thanks to Jay, Tom Shapiro. that's John's recommendation for you. We had a really fun time yesterday. Yeah. I'll talk about the.
How about talking about swaps? How about I saw a picture with, I don't know, was Ellsworth or Mitch Tinney that rode him around in a stock saddle up to the racing office to make some entries.
I love it.
Back in the day,
Well, we've had the conversation about, when you were young and working up.
Loma Rica?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, with Noor.
Yeah, and right. Get non-Noor.
Yeah, sure.
Well, the meet for you, give us give us some of the previews. What win did you have? Was it Del Mar that I don't know where I was. I think I was somewhere that I didn't get a chance to reach out to you.
Yeah, it was Justique ran in the race.
That's right, that's right, that's right.
Right, and 7/8, I think it was Desi Arnaz. And she ran really well, and we're looking forward to finding a good spot here for her.
Well, we talked about, you know, she's been, she immediately was a lightning rod horse with right. with the big closing kick in the debut, and then sort of a moderate figure. And we did talk after that because of a different stake, of a stake winner. And you said you weren't concerned that she, you know, that she would get faster as required.
Yeah, well, I wasn't. She missed a lot of training for the chandelier, so it was just taking a shot there for the Breeders' Cup, and because she didn't run well in the chandelier and wasn't really ready, we decided to skip that.
Well, and frankly, you might have been better off anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, then submit her to the, you know, big full field and everything that, you know, if they're not ready for that experience, you can spoon feed them.
Right, yeah, it would have required shipping across country and everything, so just decided to wait.
Well, exactly. So plenty of time to put her on, you know, on the trail toward the Santa Anita Oaks. What kind of, in terms of development, I mean, what do you see? You know, physical development, mental development, you know, is there, what parts of the puzzle still need to be?
A lot.
Yeah.
a lot of parts, right?
A lot of moving parts, as they say.
I think as a trainer, you know, always looking for a little bit more, and sometimes the horses don't show it to you right away. So, you know, every day is an adventure.
There's probably no better example to ask you about than Zenyatta, who, you know, with that closing style, how much more, you know, quote unquote speed, and tactical, you know, tactical foot can you train into a horse?
Not a lot, right? Not a lot. And the beauty of Zenyatta was that she had so much class and so much talent. If they went fast in the beginning, she could catch them. If they went slow in the beginning, she was closer. So Didn't have as much to do, yeah. So with her class and talent, it was a great advantage.
Well, you did have a big finish to Del Mar, and more than just Steak, because that England's Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yeah. and Beyond Brilliant.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, boy. Beyond Brilliant lost by a whisker and had a little bit of trouble, right? And England's Rose, we were just so proud of her because she's been a horse that's been on and off, and really liked her a lot. And, you know, she showed her class.
What, do you have? It's almost the timing. Well, probably wait for the next round of stake opportunities for both of them.
Yeah, because we were pretty aggressive at Del Mar,
to get them in.
Yeah, so we have to now give them a break, but let them down a little bit and then bring them back up.
What, you know, we talked yesterday. I had a really, for the fact, those listening to the replay, they just listened to visits with Jack Carava and Mark Glatt, because you can't have Glatt without Carava or Carava without Glatt. And we talked about the surfaces,
mm-hmm.
and the sort of ebb and flow that the last several years, basically the last, I call it 5, 6, 7 years, including the difficulties. But then, you know, the tracks got very heavy and slow, and that puts a different kind of demand on a horse. And both of them kind of feel like the pendulum swinging back a little bit. And their surfaces, you know, Del Mar, they said, were a little tighter over the summer, was tighter this fall, and that even this racetrack, a little bit tighter. What's been your experience?
Well, I agree with them quite a bit. I haven't really worked anything on this track yet, so I can't really say, but... One of the things with a you know, somewhat of a laboring track is the recovery on a horse, which makes a big difference in how you prepare them and how much work you can give them. But I think, you know, you kind of have to take the track surface out of the equation and train accordingly, because if you're always worried about the track surface, then it's always something that's stressful, and there are enough stresses without that.
So, in other words, basically let the horse tell you how to react to how deep and tiring it is, and terms of spacing work and in terms of, you know, leaning on them accordingly.
Yeah, because they're not going to change the track, right?
No.
So you have to adapt to it.
Yeah, and that all gets into having, you know, good communication with the riders too, and you know, and then seeing how much they're blowing when they come back and what you anticipated versus how they came back.
Sure. Yeah.
There you go. The other part of that we talked about was and I was going to hoping to have Chris Merz, but he's back in Kentucky for the Graded State Committee meeting, so we'll do it by phone with Chris. The challenge, John, the stakes calendar is one thing, and you've got stake horses, but in terms of maidens and in terms of potential allowance horses and even, you know, the tweeners, in terms of being able to train them for a target and then the target, you know, being yanked out from under and because races don't fill. What's your practice in terms of trying to keep horses in a fitness level when you don't know when the race is going to go?
Right. So I just sort of try to train on an even level, right? And hopefully maybe give them a little of stiffer work before a race, but not a lot, because like you say, the race might not go. So maybe you have to use one race to get your horse ready for another race.
Yeah, and you're not somebody worried about win percentage.
No.
Yeah. No. Tells you a lot. That's one, and that's a different equation and a challenge for a certain, you know, for certain trainers on a certain career arc too. I mean that they don't want their number. Mm-hmm. You know, that's become, I mean, it's the craziest stat that nobody ever gave a crap about for decades, for the breadth of racing history. And then all of a sudden, got to have a guy winning 24%. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I can remember when first time runners hardly ever broke their maidens.
Sure.
Now you listen to everybody, they're exposed to win their first time out, or else they're not any good.
Exactly.
I mean, it's crazy.
How much of that is trainer, is owner demand?
No, I think it's industry demand. Okay. I think it's what's been sort of projected out on the on the television and things like that. So it's expected. Some people really push to win the first time out. I remember Merlin Volsky. I was just starting to train. I had my first 2-year-old, and I didn't know anything, right? So I'm in the paddock. Here I am talking to Merlin Volsky, you know, one of the really great riders in California. And I started to tell him something. He said, "Hey, John, wait a minute. This is what we're going to do. You know, I'm going to get out of the gate. I'm going to kind of get a good position. And then we'll wait. And we'll see if the horse has a little finish." And that was it. He got on the horse and off he went. You know, Marilyn told me.
Well, and we've laughed with you about about your history, because we got to a point with you where everybody, well, you know, John Jervis isn't going to ask him to win early, win first. However, if we go back to 505 days,
yeah,
you won first out, and you absolutely could just get whatever work was necessary out of the way so that they popped.
All right, yeah, because they like to bet on them first out, so you know you have to adjust your training if you want to keep your job, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But there was a big fall off, right? There's a big fall off after they put that effort into their first race. There was a big fall off between the second and third race,
and then they'd have to come,
if they had the class, yeah. Otherwise, they may never run as well.
That's interesting, and they never, but they didn't. They didn't mind, right? Because and that's, you know, that it's so funny because that it's a betting game. That, I mean, that drives, you know, owners and betting drive the sport, and it's so odd that when the subject of betting comes up, the people are like, they're betting. Yeah, they're betting. The owners are betting. The players are betting. That's why we're here.
Yeah, the grooms are betting.
And some people take issue. It's like, oh, well, they're trying to put one over. Okay, yeah, yeah. Charlie Whittingham, all the greatest trainers that we hold in such high esteem. You don't think he wasn't setting some up for betting opportunities?
Sure, yeah.
It's unbelievable. That's what makes it great. Let me get back. John Sheriff's with us. If you haven't recognized the voice and the reference to certain horses, Manistique and Zenyatta and the like, that maiden breaker courtside.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got there?
Well, I was really happy with him because he's a Gormley, right?
You got to build up your stallions.
That was close to my heart. Yeah, that was great. And it was a little unexpected. I had another horse in there, Pelagio, which I thought it would run really well. And when Courtside got a little opening, he just switched leads and opened up on him. So he showed a lot there.
He was a Timonium purchase, $450,000 CRK. And that's an interesting topic. I had a wonderful, did you and Dottie listen to David with me at Keeneland?
Dottie listens to you every day. Well, I'm working, so
maybe on the drive back and forth. It had a wonderful we had a sure. Unbelievable flight line conversation with David, and when I see this, the 2-year-old in training, talk about your thoughts on getting 2-year-olds from the farm that were developed as yearlings versus them coming out of the breeze up type sales. And because I remember that we went through a period where I asked every trainer for it must have been during a winter. I remember asking Kieran and Peter Miller about the philosophy of either going on with them or letting the air out of the balloon and letting them sort of get their head back together. Obviously it's an individual, but what's your thoughts?
Well, I think that's exactly right. It's an individual thing. Each horse is an individual, and you have to adjust to what the horse can do. Obviously, when you buy a horse out of a 2-year-old training, you're hoping to go on with it, right? Because it has all that training and it has that speed work, so you hope you can go on with it. And, some of the things that may happen is that bring it back to the barn and suddenly an ankle fills up, or got a little filling in the knee, or he's got a cut in his mouth and he's lugging out. So all those things play a part in whether or not you're going to be able to go on with the training sale. But that's what you hope to do, right? Because you don't want to lose all that training. Versus a horse coming from the farm. Horse coming from the farm probably hasn't had the pounding on its legs that it needs to adapt to a major racetrack. So you have to spend a little time toughening up their legs so they can withstand the training that they're going to have to do. So at the 2-year-old training, you have a horse that's already been toughened up. Off the farm, you have to toughen them up. So it's, it's individual things. Some horses at the 2-year-old can go right on, other ones can't. Some horses from the farm can just go every step, make every stage you need. So it's a tough call.
Well, and I imagine there's also the habit and practice that you get from the experience, depending on the outfit, on the training, on the training center or the the developer, whoever started the horse, particularly if it's from a yearling to a to a 2-year-old, and what their quote unquote best at or what their style is, and so that you get familiar with what you may still need to do with a horse and how quickly you discover what does need to be done.
Yeah, well, we're really fortunate because the horses that come from the farm and are broken in Ocala go to Mayberry's farm, and they do a really good job, and their track is pretty busy. They have other trainers using it, so the horses get a lot of experience with things going by them, other horses going by them, and so that really helps when they come here. And David and Gordo is a really good bloodstock agent, so he knows the people that have prepared the horse in the 2-year-old in training and its background, so you have a little bit of help that way also.
Well, the key is just identify what you've got and then make the most and fill out. I mean, is there it's a crazy question. Is there a bad kind of a fitness, meaning that a horse has been doing, you know, too much of a certain kind of exercise that isn't giving it, you know, a well-rounded fitness.
Well, I think there's a bad fitness as far as the trainer's concerned, right? I train a certain type of horse better than I train another type of horse, right?
Which kinds?
So if I get a horse out of the two-year-old training sale that's very aggressive and wants to run off and is difficult to handle, I have a hard time with that kind of horse because, you know, I'd like him to have a little slower mental attitude, right? So longer stride, you know, let's breathe okay. Where somebody else wants to go 4.5 or something, that might be a perfect horse for them because they're just ready to roll. So, it's, you know, it's the horse has to fit the trainer a little bit, you know. And then, of course, with young horses, it's, you know, how much pounding have they had and how much development in the bones have they had, right? So there's, you might get one out of the sale that looks okay, and then you work it a few times, run it once, you say, oh, I got to back off of this one because it's starting to...
It's shitty.
You know, well, shitty, or maybe its ankles are starting to fill, or, you know, you can see that, you know, it's having trouble with its bones. So then you have to, you know, okay, I'll have to stop on this one for a little while. So, I mean, there are just a lot of little different things, like a horse off the farm, you've seen it come along, so you've seen every stage. And then you have maybe a little better idea of where it is in its development.
That actually segues beautifully to a question that I don't think I've brought up with you in recent memory. The state of the game regarding the HISA initiatives and working on an assumption. We're going to talk to Eric Hamelbeck in a little bit here. Working on an assumption there will be some sort of authority, some sort of a body that harmonizes things. In terms of, you know, in terms of therapeutic meds, and when you say ankle filling, and in terms of you know, anti-inflammatory use and things, what's your thought overall, John, on where we are and where we might be headed and what people should think about it?
You know, I think that the industry has done a disservice to the trainers. I think that when they come out and say this person has a drug positive, I can't remember when an illegal drug was found in a horse. I can't. I mean, we've had overages, you know. Maybe this horse had some ACE and it didn't get out of its system, or had a little bit of a high bu count. So all those things are just overages, and it's not like anybody has tried to do anything illegal or race fix. So I think the way they've explained this to the public has been terrible. And I think that really needs to change because you get to be a trainer because you love horses. So I don't understand why they've forgotten about that.
We've said this for the as long as we've been doing this, and it's been one of the refrains that have really the demonization of the training community by a body that is supposed to be protecting the you know, the breed. I've called it carpet bombing, essentially, is just unbelievable. And the effort, you know, to find ourselves where we are, essentially because a certain percentage wanted to eliminate Lasix from the game, is really a disservice.
Yeah, no, I don't understand that, because if an owner buys a horse for $200, $300, whatever, and it's a bleeder, and it's a good enough horse to run in stakes, then he can no longer run in stakes, and you're not protecting that owner's investment at all. How do you expect that man to come back and spend some more money on a horse?
Well, and how do we as horse players, how do we, you know, how do we evaluate? I mean, we went to this Breeders' Cup, and it was every horse in the gate that was coming off of Lasix, and even if they weren't coming off Lasix, just a complete crapshoot. I mean, the Japanese filly and Tim Martin's horse, Baffert had Messier that bled. That had, yeah. I mean, it's not fair. I mean, and you know, you're certainly thought of as a purist, and yet here you are acknowledging that there's benefit and you know, a prophylactic positive to, you know, to the Lasix certainly, and even, you know, on the therapeutic side. I mean, what's your policy or relationship with your vet about this? Because one of the obvious challenges is going to be that the vets are going to have to, you know, there's all the testing methods are going to change, and they're not, you know, we looks like we bought ourselves maybe, I don't know, 6 months, who knows,
right.
But you know, how do you protect yourself, you know, as a businessman, and how do you, you know, how do you handle that with your vet?
Well, I think you have to go back a little bit farther, because I think you have to understand what a racehorse is doing, how he's training, how he's exercising, how he's resting. So you have a horse that maybe is in its stall 23 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the horses that naturally are out grazing, moving around, because that's how they get circulation. So when they say that you cannot, for workout, that you cannot give the horse any therapy, you cannot put a little massage machine on it, you can't put a heating pad on it to increase the blood flow, to me that doesn't make any sense. I think they need to go back and think about what's good for a horse and what's bad for our industry, and talk about it with everybody involved. My horseshoer, Wes Champagne, which is well respected,
sure,
around the country, right?
Sure.
He said nobody even called him about shoes, about whether a horse could have a outside toe grab or anything like that. So I think they need to go back to the people that are actually working with the horses, or hands-on with the horses, and ask them what they need to make this business go, right? You talk to the people in academia, you know, they have a whole different perspective on it. As you know, as we know about when they talk about statistics. Sure, statistics work for a huge, large population. They don't work for the individual. So they need to think about the individual a little bit. And just go back to the basics.
You just smile. Give us a. No. I taking a picture of John for the listing. You gotta go. I hear you. Who's working? Anybody?
Just some horses.
You're gonna give it. Oh boy.
You know, you never tell an agent the horse's name either. So what the heck?
John Sheriffs, everybody. Always spectacular. John, have a great meet.
Thank you.
John Sheriffs, what a great way to start. And Dottie's home listening, I hope. Dottie, good morning. I love it. That was great. You know, who's more respected than John Sheriffs, right? Watching here, they just tractors just left, and that cavalcade busts out that was all ready to go. The sheriff's horses, for those that when you come to the racetrack, when you come and you do want to come to Clocker's Corner, of course, the, you know, identifying. I mean, there's certain saddle cloths that are instantly familiar. And John happens to be one of them. He's got the navy blue with two white bars, one horizontal and one vertical, that meet on the edges and cross in the lower left-hand corner. The sheriff's saddle cloth. Baffert with the blue and yellow diamonds, instantly familiar. As I mentioned the other day, even in the dark, maybe it's me, but it feels like the sun got up earlier this morning. Well, it's 6:30, so all right. It feels like it. It just feels brighter here this morning. Maybe just because it was cloudy the first couple of days. But as I mentioned the other day, I could pick off Vladimir Serin very easily with the purple and the VC. So Doug O'Neill's black and white. You know, it's funny. You just get very used to, you know, when you come out in the morning. But when you come here this year, for those that are planning, you know, there's so many people, you know, that are fairly new to the sport, you know, that, you know, have wanted for the last few years to attend, you know, some of their favorite venues. But, you know, between pandemic and everything that kind of tamped down on all of us, if you didn't get a chance, when you come here, this is one of the places that you get to really take in the game the way you would like. In fact, here's a sheriff's horse right now. See if I can't get a decent. There we go. All right, I'll put that up so you can see his saddle cloth. You can see what I'm talking about. But you got to come early. And in fact, there was I guess it was the first time that I brought Tina out here, and I kept, you know, telling her, "You got to come out one morning. You got to come out one morning." And she was ambivalent, you know, about getting up at getting up at the crack of dawn, before the crack of dawn, and coming here for 6 a.m. And so finally, one morning she came, and now. I mean, not that she's been lately, because it's been very difficult to get her out for these out to the West Coast, because of school. So, but she now absolutely just loves it. So make sure that when you come here, if you're going to come for Big Cap weekend or Santa Anita Derby weekend, you carve out the morning leading up. You know, don't just show up and, you know, on Saturday afternoon. Come out Thursday morning, Friday morning, and take this in, because it's very special. And everybody that is listening that's been here is nodding their head and saying, absolutely, it's my favorite place. Well, Breeders' Cup. When the Breeders' Cup is here, and we'll be back here next fall, but the Breeders' Cup is just a little different. It's still great, but just during the meet, there's a certain special conviviality, and I will put up that watercolor picture that is at this point now bittersweet. There's that picture that. Had the guys in the corner table with Barry Abrams and Henry Marino and Mel Studi, and in way too rapid fashion, the three of them gone. And There's a lot of things that when I think about it, and in fact, I mentioned the lunch we had yesterday, John Parada and Jay Hovde getting together at Guido's in Santa Monica, which was itself part of the show, and we had really a wonderful time discussing a million different things, all revolving around the game and film and TV, because that, you know, you can't help it with those two. especially Hovde's Hovde, movies. Apparently, he's watching 6 movies a day. That was the estimate that John and I came up with. He's 12, half the day. He's picking up and dropping off Lorelai and then watching movies the rest of the time. But there were a few things that came up, including Joe Hirsch, wouldn't hurt a baby, and Joe Hirsch's propensity to pick up lunch and dinner tabs. But there's so many things that, as we come toward the year end, actually, you get to reflect on and think about. And the things that, and to be honest, the passing of JJ also kind of triggered some of these thoughts this week. But just the things that have been treated to and realizing just how many moments in racing history I've actually had the privilege of witnessing and being, you know, adjacent to, and the individuals too. As it happens, I saw this morning, I got up, you know, wake up at crazy hours when you're on the West Coast, and I saw that, I think it was from yesterday, but that it was the sad anniversary of Garrett Gomez's passing. And so, you know, I thought about that, sort of triggered some other kinds of thoughts about, you know, some of the people we've had the responsibility really to honor upon their passing. So that includes, you know, includes Gomez, a moving 3-hour tribute to him, and Bobby Frankel and Alan Jerkins, Jack Vanberg, you know, all come to mind. So feel very privileged to be a place like this, and you know, and just as privileged to go tomorrow to Remington, be there for their closing weekend. Looking forward to it. The opportunity to talk to I was going to say to Eric Hamelbeck. Let me see if Eric is good now. And I've also got we've got kind of a moving part schedule today. Mig at some point this morning, I know. Nate, as mentioned, Nate Newby was going to stop by. We'll talk to Seth Merrill later. And I've absolutely forgot. Oh, no Sid until tomorrow. Sid has got some obligations this morning. So Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale tomorrow. And we had a bit of a, let's see, I'm missing. Okay, Eric says good now. Gary, how are you? Good to see you. You all right?
I'm surprised to see you there.
I'm always happy to be here. It feels like we've turned the corner. I mentioned Mel. There's Gary Studi, one of the great characters. Papa Clem, right? I think we may have paved over Dick this morning. Dick Powell, I had expected to get a hold of Dick, but then things sort of changed. So let's all right, so I guess we will, it's quarter of. Let me It may go like this the rest of the morning. Because now I don't see when it's great to have a John Sheriff's kick off the show, but you, from that point you don't know what exactly, you know, what's going to happen from that point forward. Eric Hamelback, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I hate to pave over Dick Powell, I'm one of my good friends, so if you want to try him again.
Well, we miss, at this point, we miss the morning at...
Missed the mark.
Yeah, at Happy Valley, so I apologize to Dick. Well, he was on Monday. We recapped the HKIR, so it's not like Dick didn't get a chance to say hello to everybody. I might still reach out to him. Eric, I don't know if you had a chance yesterday. You had a busy Monday, whatever yesterday was, Tuesday. Alan Foreman joined us on the heels of the FTC, essentially kicking the Haiwu rules down the, you know, down the path. And I read your statement, referred to your statement, and here's a chance to get some further thoughts, what this means, and you know, what the latest positioning since we talked last week.
Right, it's definitely a case of things moving at the speed of light. There's no doubt about that. So I appreciate the opportunity to come on, and I did get to hear a bit of Alan towards the end yesterday after jumping off some calls. So always appreciative of his analysis for certain from the attorney aspect. But I guess what I want to maybe open up with is really just a statement that I've tried to continue to proclaim, and now it's come to fruition. And redundancy creates chaos, right, Steve? And what has continued to occur with HISA has been, for the most part, redundancy. I actually was able to hear, I think, most of John Sheriff's piece. And boy, you know, from my days with Giacomo and when he was retired, he's always been kind of a pillar of light, and Miss Dottie as well. But, you know, for him to say the words, they need to be asking the people who are in the trenches. I'm paraphrasing a bit, telling the story. Yep. About his farrier, I think really should shed some light on all the chaos that's been created through HISA. But we definitely need to reset. We need to redo it. Again, Just like I said, when we were at the symposium, everybody is and has wanted uniformity. We just need to go about it the right way. But what happened essentially about 5:43 yesterday, or day before yesterday, with that announcement from the FTC, I feel is the right announcement. I mean, the FTC is doing what the Act defines the FTC to do. So there's a lot of talk out there right now about the FTC, you know, exerting power, and how does that affect litigation? And I say that it doesn't. And I want to be very clear about this aspect. The Act was never disputed from the category of the FTC having the power to approve or disprove the regulations that were submitted. What they don't have the power to do, and obviously proven in the Fifth Circuit opinion, is they can't modify, they can't amend, they can't recommend. So that's where the issues from the unconstitutionality come from. It's not because they disapprove the Act. In fact, if you look at the order that was issued in their non-approval, they state very clearly it's not consistent with the Act. And that's never been disputed. So the FTC judged, as it were, what was going on. And because of the ruling in the Fifth Circuit, they know, and they explained, uniformity, which is the premise of HISA, could not be achieved. And they went on to further say, as I interpret, they will not approve it until the litigation or the constitutionality issue is resolved. So as far as I'm concerned, and certainly everyone has the right to have a different legal opinion, but certainly as far as I'm concerned, the ADMC portion is off the shelf until litigation is resolved. Now, how long is that going to take? I don't know. But at this point, that is what I'm going to interpret and kind of move forward. Again, hoping that we can come to some sort of resolve, you know, in getting and finding proper uniformity. But the other thing that I think that came out that I don't think many people are realizing, you know, I don't remember the date exactly, Steve, but, you know, the group, the corporation under HISA actually was sending out, you know, allocations for budgets. They were making letters of statement for credits. They were defining what each racetrack actually owed for 2023. And all of this was done before and still has not had a budget for 2023 approved by the FTC. So again, I find that extremely alarming. You know, we've pointed to the catchphrase that has become very synonymous with HISA, and that's non-transparency. So the budget that everyone has been looking at for the past couple of months for 2023 has never even been approved by the FTC. I don't think that the letter was preceded by, you know, we'll have this knowledge of the budget confirmed once the FTC approves it. Everyone's just been acting as such. So that was a bit alarming as we were digging deeper into the situation with the FTC announcement. But I think the biggest statement from me right now is at least we have a pause, we have a check. There's not going to be this 10-day enforcement. You saw some of the HISA representatives and the HEWU or whatever their acronym is telling us that, you know, you've got a new Bible. I mean, that was kind of offensive to me. I'm not going to lie to you, but at the end of the day, there was an arrogance, so to speak, of we're going to enforce this for 10 days and you better be ready. Now we don't have to worry about that. And so at this point, we'll be able to hopefully sit back, kind of evaluate things and go from there. I'm going to pause, Steve, before I go on to my next rant in case you have a question.
No, I just wanted to get your gut reaction and, sure. You know, given what Ed Martin had asked and suggested last week when we were at Arizona and, you know, had basically called for a delay. And as I brought up yesterday with Alan, it does feel like this is a service to the long-term interests of everybody involved.
Right. Obviously, we all know, and Ed makes it very clear that the ARCI is not on either side. They're very neutral. Obviously, he's got members that are certainly on one side or the other and several that are on the opposition side. But yes, they're bored in the best interest of what they see as in the industry. They did call for the pause. And there was a lot of things going on, especially towards the end of last week when a lot of us were at the Nickel G's conference. There was a lot of discussions going on that ultimately culminated in what occurred through the workings of our attorney groups, their attorney groups, and then ultimately some of the calls from the industry, such as ARCI, that led to that FTC disapproval of the current regulations that they have in their hands. But the other thing that I really want to jump to, Steve, is, you know, I would tell you that unfortunately, those of us who still want to do things the right way are still on a bit of defensive position because of the announcement, one might say, that Senator McConnell is going to put in something in the omnibus package. We can't confirm that. We can't not confirm that that's going to happen. But what I can say is that if they were to do that, they being the Power Four or Senator McConnell that put something in the omnibus package, that really just gets us right back to square one, but it doesn't help anything. If they are trying to fix one aspect of the bill, certainly let us see it. There's been no text released. No one knows, again, if a fix is in or if it's not in. But what aspect is one trying to fix at this point? Because, again, if you do, quote unquote, fix the opinion from the Fifth, that does not stop the fact that there are many unconstitutionality aspects of HISA that are still being challenged. And so, you know, we are still urging as an industry, do not try to do this to the industry again. Again, redundancy creates chaos. And if they do it again, there's going to be more chaos. If they slip it in this cloak and dagger fashion, without any proper procedural protocol for a bill, and it gets signed because everybody has to vote on, you know, funding the budget, that is not the right way, and it is redundant of what chaos has been created thus far, and it is absolutely sickening to me if that were to occur. So if you're out there and you, in my opinion, oppose or support HISA, you should be asking not to have this bill slip through again on a piece of must-pass legislation, because that doesn't do anything for our industry. It doesn't help us. It doesn't get us to move forward, and it damn sure isn't going to stop litigation. So if you're out there and you want to speak to your federal representatives, there are many ways to get that done, including going to our website or going to some of our more recent posts on Facebook and Twitter. Contact them, even if you support it, because nothing's going to stop if he slips something in. That I can assure you. So I really want to make a plea towards anyone listening out there. Do not let your federal representatives slip something else in, a redundancy of what they did before, and create more chaos. It is absurd.
Well, and that part of the, you know, the instituting of the authority, that, you know, that basically started it off on the wrong foot. And,
yes, sir.
I mean, we said that from day one. And what, you know, one thing that I've been carrying around from the weekend, I guess it came out of a Friday news dump regarding the reportage of the potential for McConnell to create what is termed a legislative fix, but that you and Martin and Alan Foreman all acknowledged is not going to stop or you know instantly make this constitutional.
Correct.
But the letter that was sent to him from the 9 attorneys general. How much impact comes from with that? What kind of response? I didn't see any follow-up to it.
There has not been any response from Senator McConnell's office that I am aware of, to be honest. But obviously, the attorney generals and more that have now seen the letter have agreed to agree with the premise. But I think that it is impactful because that is, in my opinion, further proof that more litigation would be to come if you were to try to do something like that, he being Senator McConnell. And obviously, you know, Senator McConnell is a very powerful individual. And at the end of the day, I consider him one of the Power Four. So he's proven it before. He can do it. But surely to God, when he's talking about the effects of an entire industry, he would listen to the industry. And as I see it, the vast majority of people are still pushing back on this. And that's why we need your voice to flood his office with that very message. And the attorney generals are extremely upset, especially the ones that have signed on to that letter. The flag waving that General Landry has done in my home state of Louisiana makes it very clear that this is not going to stop if something like this were to be put into another omnibus package. And it again is not what's good for the industry. And to be the signature industry of the state that I live in now, again, I think it's absurd that when you hear an industry divided, you would try to do something for one side. And I would actually, you know, highlight that point. You know, up until almost August 1st of 2020, we being the National HBPA, were consistently told from Senator McConnell's office that, you know, they were going to be neutral, as it were, until the industry was combined in the efforts. You know, the current attorney general for the state of Kentucky was working for Senator McConnell at the time, and literally told us in a physical meeting in D.C. That Senator McConnell wanted to see the industry bring something together to help move forward. And that is a complete contrast to what is now going on. So I would hope that he would listen to that historical message that was given by his own staff. Don't do something the industry is divided on, because the industry is divided deeply on this topic.
There you go. I don't know what else there is, you know. What else there is to say?
You got it, Steve?
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't know what else there is to say. I honestly, I mean, you said it. I can tell. I mean, your thoughts on this are fully coalesced. right?
Must be the coffee.
Well, either way, I love it. Well, Eric.
Well, you know, again, thank you, Steve. You know, I come to work every day fairly early. I'm at the training center here on Paris Pike. You know, I love where we are because I get to see what these guys do every day. You know, I often joke and say I get to stand on the rail on my phone and watch horses go by like every other trainer does. But it gives me a sense of grounding to understand where the vast majority of this industry is. You know, it's the industry has the upper echelon, but at the end of the day, the vast majority are small agribusiness participants, and they make a living in this industry. You know, this is professional horse racing, but they're not paid like professional athletes, right? These guys make a living in this industry, and sometimes, as we know, the margins of profit are razor thin. And so to get by sometimes, some months, is very difficult. But that's what gives me my passion. You know, I've been in this industry essentially since I was 15 years old on the backside of a racetrack. And there's nobody that's going to tell me people don't do what they do every day in this industry for any other reason than passion and love of the horse. And by God, I've got it, and I am not going to stop until we see this industry get together, all together, and move forward. You know, if I could say one last thing, reverting back to Mr. Sheriffs, who I respect greatly, you know, at the end of the day, he talked very poignantly, you and he did, about, you know, it's the presentation of the industry that has a problem on many fronts. A minor overage, right, is not a doping violation that gets put out in the press.
Yep.
So we've got a lot of work to do. We've got some entities that are already in place. They need to do their job.
There you go. Coach Belichick joining us this morning.
All right.
Eric, I appreciate it. But, you know, particularly you talk about poignant, In the face of some nasty critique of people that interpret this you know, this stand essentially, and the position of you and HBPA, the characterization of it as trying to protect cheaters is about as disgusting a posture as I've ever seen. And if anything is a litmus test for people that are wrongheaded about this conversation, that's it.
That's it. Agreed, 100%.
Eric Hamelbeck, everybody. Eric the Tiger and National HBPA. Eric, we will probably talk. We certainly will talk before the Christmas break next Friday.
Absolutely.
All right?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Steve, thank you. Travel safe, brother.
Eric Hamelbeck, folks, let's take a break. I just heard from Sid, who actually is now available. He's broken free. He's broken from the pack. So we will have Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale. We will have it next, which is good, because that kind of frees up tomorrow. We'll be at Remington and hope to, as that meet rounds out, hope to have, you know, a handful of the great horsemen and individuals that work there and are getting ready for the big springboard mile card. A lot of big draws today, actually. You've also got the Futurity at Los Al drawing today, and the rest of the Saturday cards. So we'll have the visit from Sid. We've got Tom Law lined up. Mig is due for a visit. Seth Merrow as well. And I see Vince DeGregory sitting over here holding court, as Vince has done for, I don't know, 75 years. You think I'm kidding? For those of you who don't know Vince DeGregory, who happened to have been born in Greenwich, his hometown, as a child. He literally, for those that know about Wally's, he literally was born above Wally's in like 1919. No one knows. I mean, when Vince goes, they're going to have to cut him in half and count the rings. Hey, now. I got a million of them. All stolen from somebody. It's been a slow build these 3 days at Santa Anita, and it finally, in terms of a kind of a bustling crowd on the Palazzo, there aren't too many racetracks that you can use the word Palazzo. What did Mr. Faversham say in Caddyshack? Good golly, I'm hot today. just gorgeous. Just looking out here. Some horses. You know, one of the great moments in training is when different horses from different outfits just sort of hook up, you know, even if they're just galloping. And you know, all of a sudden, you just had three horses that sort of came together at the top of the stretch, and you could tell each of them, you know, the riders kind of leaned forward, and the horses each got aggressive with each other. So great to be here. Back after this, Sid Fernando, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. We're live at Santa Anita.